When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome back to the Shop Podcast. I'm Joe Dyer and I'm here in Sydney as ever with Charles Firth.
Hello.
Joining us from Hobart, the indomitable Grace Tame.
G'day.
And coming back for his second appearance on the Shop Podcast from Canberra, we have John Domenico.
Hello.
Now, John is joining us today because he wrote an article for the Shop last week in which he talked about the non-existent Yes campaign. And I think it's fair to say that there has been some concern amongst all progressive thinking Australians that so far the Yes campaign hasn't been getting the traction that we would like. And the polls, unreliable as they may be, and indeed often are, have been trending in the wrong direction. The trajectory is not what you would call positive. Lots of people have views on this, and certainly we're hearing from Canberra that once the campaign gets out of Canberra and is amongst the people, that is where traction will occur. But John, you're still worried, it's fair to say?
I am concerned based on just everything we've seen so far that there doesn't really seem to be any like indication that they're going to change directory. It's like they're doing the same thing that we saw in the UK for the Brexit Stay campaign, which led to the Stay campaign being wiped out, despite being the default choice, which means that Yes has an even bigger uphill battle here. This whole like strategy of big business and not talking about any of the nuance seems to not be working. And for some reason, there's just no sign that they want to shift gears like 10 months into it not working.
No, I think that they're, look, clearly, as we've discussed before, the overarching strategy was originally get into the weeds as little as possible so that that can't be used to throw dust in our eyes, that that if you get mired in the complexity, that's where you open up the possibility of if you don't know, vote no, as opposed to if you don't know, get off your ass and find out. So everybody always talked about the failure of the Republican referendum as indicating that what we should have done first is just gone for that a plebiscite on the broad issue. Do you think that Australians should have an Australian head of state? And then once that had been established and supported with enthusiasm, presumably by all of the country, that that's when you could start talking about the model. So the principle first, detail later. And clearly that is the playbook that now the Labor Party in particular are deploying. But now, of course, we have, and it is a disingenuous and it is a cynical campaign that's coming from the other side of politics and the opposition, saying, well, where is the detail? But the fact is that it does at the moment seem to be working.
I feel like what's happening is the Yes campaign is staggering around with sawdust in their eyes in a room full of sawdust, going, well, at least we don't have more sawdust than there is at the moment. If we just stick to the strategy, we'll only have this much sawdust in our eyes.
And, you know, even with a small amount of sawdust in your eyes, it can be hard to actually see out of said eyes. But, look, it is also the case that the campaign is starting to ramp up. I mean, not a moment too late or too soon, you'd think. But so, for example, I have now started to – there is a big event on Sunday, the 2nd of July. So in all capital cities around the country, there are going to be big community days. And they the Yes campaign, Yes23 is the official website, has now started to send out information about that and to try and marshal the volunteers and turn it much more into the community independent style campaign where you do gather support from the grassroots and then you start to see this sort of upswell in a way that people weren't necessarily expecting. Before you know it, every second person's wearing a, you know, Yes23 t-shirt and off we go on a wave of enthusiasm to success at the referendum. Well, I mean, that's the strategy.
One weird thing with that strategy, which I linked to an ABC article in my article that like talks about that, because one weird thing that they catch internal criticism from is that they're not doing anything to bring on board anyone who's done grassroots campaigns before. And it's this like really weird thing of like, get up, put their hands up because they're run by Indigenous people and they got told, like they just got completely ignored. The people who organized the Invasion Day rallies, they also are getting like not brought in.
But do you think that might just be because it's like people are getting their ducks in a row? I mean, look, and to be honest, GetUp. I mean, look, I love GetUp. I love what they stand for. But have they really had much impact on Australian politics for all of the colour and movement? I mean, don't come at me, GetUp people.
Honestly,
but
the main
seriously,
thing I know about GetUp is from the Chaser sketch a couple of years ago that was like, GetUp and vote Labor.
Yeah. I mean, if that's the only thing you really know about GetUp, are they really cutting through? I mean, when I was running as the independent in Boothby, there was a lot of them and they were, you know, creating more little how to vote cards that they would stand next to everybody else handing out how to vote cards and giving everyone, you know, point systems for how progressive they were. And you kind of thought, well, we could probably do that ourselves. I don't know that having you there is value adding that much, GetUp. Although I think your intent is good, GetUp, don't get me wrong. But I guess it is that thing, is it like, are we now starting to see, I mean, if you think about the community independence campaigns, like a lot of them hadn't even picked their candidates by the end of the year. And then come May, they won. Now, that's a very small localised sample, of course, and we need to see that happening everywhere.
That's also a longer time period than we're going to have for the vote, probably.
October 14, by all accounts, after the footy finals. That's what everybody was saying, although, you know, if it looks like we're still in dire straits, whether or not that can be pushed back. But Thomas Mayo was saying
the legislation is that it's got to be held within 6 months of the legislation being passed. So.
And if it goes much later than that, then you get into wet season in the territory and that's bad for access to polling booths for a lot of people living outside of the cities. So, you know, October 14 is probably still our key, most immutable deadline for this.
I've got a strategy.
Yes.
Oh, yeah?
Which is, I reckon at the last minute they should change the question. So it's, do you not want a voice? And then anyone who votes yes, you know, is actually voting.
So it's like the bait and switch kind of, yeah.
Exactly. And then I reckon it would get up in all states and territories.
Do you think? So there was a little bit of, we've had two.
Because I think the thing is, it's going to actually be a small change, right? It's not the world's most profound thing. Like, it's good. It's good. Don't get me wrong. But it's not a radical change. Like, if there wasn't a referendum on it and it happened, it wouldn't actually, like, people's day-to-day lives wouldn't be drastically affected.
No, they wouldn't at all. Right. It's already happening in a legislative way in South Australia, and just, really no one has had any impact on their lives at all except for the Indigenous peoples who can now give advice in a formalised structure.
It is literally the least we can do is to be polite about asking Indigenous people on legislation that affects them what they think about it. Is literally the least
that is
we
indeed.
Can do.
And constitutionally entrenched so
obviously
that it can't
not
be.
What we're going.
No, but I think there is a point which is that hasn't been brought up by the Yes campaign, which is, I think, very strong in favour of the Yes campaign, which is it is, in fact, more impolite to ask people their opinion and then ignore them, which is entirely allowed in this legislation. Like, I would have thought that people on the conservative side of politics would like this because actually it is ruder to go, oh, yeah, have a voice to Parliament and then we'll ignore you. After you've asked them and to their face they've told you something and you go, oh, well, we're just ignoring you anyway. So in actual fact, if you are racist and want to annoy Indigenous people and be impolite to them, voting yes is the way because it's actually a more
so
impolite
we should,
thing
what
to
we're
do.
Not, what the Yes campaign not doing is promoting the racist yes strategy. That's,
I think they've
that's
got to
been
tap
their mistake.
The rich vein of racism that will
deliver. Do you think
that
that's what Albo was tapping into, what is last night based on the time of recording, when Albanese said that he thinks the problem with the entire campaign is that the media is listening to Indigenous voices who aren't in the Yes campaign and that they should stop doing that?
Well, I mean, I think
he's called for the media to ignore Lydia Thorpe completely.
I don't think you should ignore Lydia Thorpe. I do think you should ignore Jacinta Price because so far she's just a facile IPA kind of spokesperson and has done nothing of any value at all before being seized upon with glee and alacrity by the opposition to promote because she will be a vessel for their racist campaign. So I think we're happy to ignore Jacinta. Lydia, not so much. And I think Celeste Little's piece in The Guardian, I think, also went into this where she was saying, you know, the Yes campaign is asking me to put my faith into a party, a political party, the Labor Party, but also institutions that have failed us consistently every time. Mm. So be ambivalent about that is actually just good sense. But, of course, her reservations, which are valid and wise, are that to then be no, yes, you've got sort of Lydia, but you're basically aligning yourselves with the dregs of the spokespeople are the dregs. And I'm not going to get into the basket of deplorable era, but the actual spokespeople, the Hansons, the Duttons, the Jacintas, you know, these people who have contributed nothing but racism and division to our community. So you don't want to align yourself with them as an Indigenous person who's generally just ambivalent about, you know, putting faith in colonial structures and ideas such as, I think the answer to that, as I will immediately smoothly segue into, is of course that this, it has to be implemented by white institutions because that's the nature of the constitution. But the ideas sprang from, you know, the local regional communities. And I think that's what Megan Davis has gone into so well in her upcoming, well, it's just out now, quarterly essay.
Well, I think that, like I said it a lot in the article, I do think that a big issue that Yes is falling into is that Albo is trying to like small target this campaign.
Yeah.
And so he's avoiding talking about any of the nuance or any of the like genuine good faith criticisms of The Voice, some of which are like wanting to make sure to strengthen The Voice or like solidify it. Because like one of the big concerns right now is around who decides what does and doesn't get asked to The Voice. Because like if that's decided by the government, then if Dutton wins, he's just never going to talk to The Voice.
Mm.
And it's that like thing of just, we even saw it with like Thomas Mayo and Kathy Wilcox on the weekend on Twitter, that thing of like that just pretending that there's absolutely no like nuance at all and that there's no genuine cause for debate and to just ignore them all. And it's like any vote, the voters who are unsure and then see like good faith, like wanting to debate or wanting to get clarification and then just having that shut off, are just going to not trust the system if they're refusing to even like acknowledge that there is stuff to talk about with the system, because there's stuff to talk about with every system and everyone knows that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was some of the points that George Brandis was raising in his article where he was saying, you know, there is people have genuine questions. Not all of them are coming from the space of we're concerned that it might not be strong enough, you know, because of the way the debate has played out. A lot of it is also about that we're concerned that somehow it'll gum up the whole system and everything will be justiciable. And despite the fact that some of the leading constitutional lawyers and ex-judges in this country have said, guys, it's fine, because of the misinformation, the flooding with shit kind of strategy that the Dutton and the opposition are employing, this idea that somehow it is going to undermine our system of government. And so asking genuine questions about that, to just say, don't be silly, you're listening to racist Dutton, nothing to see here, move on, isn't actually elucidating the situation in any meaningful way.
And I wonder whether, therefore, they just do need to change tack and announce what the model will be. Like, isn't the way to put to bed bad faith sort of fear campaigns is to say, no, it's going to be, 15, 20, 30 people. They'll all be funded this much and here's the legislation and it's not scary, it's just...
Well, look, I mean, that is the Karma Langton model that is there, but that there has been, as John says, the small target strategy deployed. So if we're going to open up and be a big target, then, you know, there'll be ways that that will be used against the campaign as well.
But I think fundamentally what it shows is that the people who are sort of at the very centre of setting the strategy of this don't necessarily trust the Australian people. You know, they don't...
But I have let us down before, Charles.
But they don't trust that there'll be, that you can have, as John said, there'll be this good faith debate to actually, you know, they don't trust us with the model. And so, of course, the result of that is, well, okay, I don't trust you either. Like, it's just like tit for tat.
Yeah.
I don't know, especially given, like, I was totally on board with let's be vague and make it all about, you know,
the principle.
Just the vibe, right? Yeah. But it clearly is not going to work. Like, it's clearly going to fail. Like,
I mean, in the last couple of days, we've had the Yes campaign going that the polling was wrong to saying that, oh, actually, our internal polling is also showing that fall is happening as well. And it's like, so then that means that clearly that's a sign that you should try something different.
Although I must say it is true that it is long held strategic law within the Labor Party that you never change strategy. The whole thing is to have a strategy and then to not, because actually changing strategy just gets more confusing. You're better off just sticking to your strategy regardless.
As you go over the cliff.
As you go over the cliff.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Well, look, I think we will see on Sunday there's going to be a vast array of genuine grassroots events where hopefully there'll be a big wave of enthusiasm, and that is everywhere from, you know, Sydney. It's happening in Prince Albert Park, and I believe it that, well, not I believe, they are happening everywhere, and this will be kicking off the kind of the community-led section of the campaign.
And sorry, I've just been listening, and I'm just going to call bullshit on a lot of what you've been saying. Sorry. But first of all, I wonder why anybody thinks that any of the sources of the No campaign are legitimate in the first place. Sky News, not really news. The Australian, arguably not really news either.
Oh, definitely.
So you could probably just wipe out a significant portion of the No campaign as being invalid. And we can look at the Yes campaign major exponents like Teela Reid, a great Aboriginal lawyer. She runs the Black Matters podcast. I would recommend listening to that if you haven't heard of it. Curly Saunders, she's a great Aboriginal writer. Nessa Turnbull-Roberts is a great source of information. She's also a lawyer. Debbie Kilroy is somebody who you should listen to the voice of and look into the work of. She might not be talking about the voice directly, but she's somebody who is really, really great, who does really good work for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. June Oscar has talked about Australia being ready for the Indigenous voice to Parliament. So with all respect, I think it is absolute bullshit that the Yes campaign hasn't been running or isn't working. It's perhaps just a matter of questioning your sources.
No, I don't. I mean, I think I know all of those writers and have listened to a lot of what they had to say. I think the broader point, though, is it cutting through to the broader community who is not as engaged on the issue generally? And or is the fact that the amplification of the No campaign through these media outlets, I mean, look, to be honest, I don't think no one reads The Australian and no one watches Sky, but then they come through to the ABC the way the who wrote about this?
Well, Dave Milner very evocatively said that the ABC's whole thing is to just bring on Sky News presenters and Australian reporters, and because they like punching
themselves
in the face.
Nessa Turnbull-Roberts is often on the drum. She's on the drum a lot.
The drum is, I think, a noble exception. I mean,
the drum is one where it's very hit or miss.
Yeah, sure. It's a drum.
But like, in the article that I wrote, a lot of the people that Grace said were the direct people that I linked to or sourced. And it is just weird that, like, even some of their things where they're like, we should be discussing, like, this is where the topic should be. Again, like, there's just outright, like, refusal from the public-facing faces of Yes, like Albanese for that. And it's just like, it's
have
just
you
weird.
Listened? Have you listened to Teela Reid recite the Uluru Statement from the heart? Have you listened to that? I dare you to go and listen to her just recite that from memory.
Yeah, no, and look, Thomas Mayo does as well when they were doing their book tours, and there was not a dry eye in the audience, but there was only 300 people in that audience, and let's face it, they were probably already not only going to be committed Yes voters, but hand out how to vote cards on referendum day. So I think the question is, how do we ensure that these voices are heard by a wider section of the community that it carries in this really arcane and difficult kind of model?
And Grace, you're right. Like,
I mean, the voting model,
it's
not
shitty
the actual model.
That Murdoch exists, right? Like, but it's not true that he doesn't have influence. He has enormous influence. Like, actually, 70% of Australia's print media is Murdoch. Like, he has unbelievable influence. And I suppose you can wish away the idea that Yeah, well, they're invalid because they're all fuckwits.
He is a brain cancer.
But they exist. Yeah. But Murdoch does exist. Like, that's the problem. Like, you're absolutely right. Like, there's all these great, you know, sort of people saying really cogent things about yes, but it's but not enough. If you've got a thumb on the scale that's actually a massive part of the media infrastructure in this country, then you do have to adjust to that reality, don't you?
So I think, well, look, let's wait and see. I think
I think perhaps, you know, when the part of where I see the change needing to happen is, you know, and you know, I need to start doing this as well, you know, is rather than a lot of white allies, you know, offering too much context, you know, like when I do a lot of grassroots campaigning still, even as a foundation, and sometimes I will see that because there's that balance, and we talked about it last time when we talked about The Voice, is there's this fine line to walk between being an ally and you know, sort of how do we describe it? So walking alongside, but then almost doing too much of the talking, and then not allowing the whatever, you know, can transpose whatever the party is that you're trying to help, and allowing them to do the talking. So it's almost just like just platforming, vacating the space entirely, and just not providing any context at all, and just pushing them. And sort of just platforming them.
No, look, and
because this is what I've seen a lot with a lot of like white allies. If they'll write so much in a story that then the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice that they're trying to platform actually is proportionately not appreciated.
Yeah. No, look, absolutely. I think that's true. But I do think, and this is what Celeste Little said in her piece in The Guardian this week, is that, you know, activism, as you know, Grace, more than any of us around the table, is hard, exhausting, ongoing work. And so it's all very well for us to sit around and say, oh, the Yes campaign's doing this wrong. But actually, it's grassroots campaigning that now needs to take over. And hopefully some of that will start from this week.
Yeah, because a lot of stuff that makes it into the news, the sign holding, you know, and protesting, and you know, I have a lot of mob friends, and I don't mean that to say that in terms of moral licensing, you know, therefore I get to say this and this, and you know, because I voted for this person, that means I can say this. I know, as somebody who also does work that is trauma based from lived experience, just when the cameras go off, that does not mean my protesting turns off either. All the hard work continues behind the scenes, and that's what grassroots advocacy and activism, quote unquote, and activism tends to be a dirty word because it's sometimes, you know, and thanks to people like Scott Morrison who poo-pooed activism as being, you know, just something that happens really in the schoolyard, which is absolute rubbish. You know, it is happening constantly behind the scenes in order to create real change, all the way up from the bottom to the top. And so that's something that, you know, and you said this before, I think, Joe, you know, like we need to understand that, and sometimes that's missed. It's not absorbed by the average person who just consumes a soundbite or a headline or even an article. That in order to get to that point, there was days, weeks, months behind that.
So I think everyone go to the yes23.com.au website and see where the nearest event happening this Sunday, July the 2nd, is to you, because having a really big, strong turnout on this sort of first major day of community activism, I think, is important.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Picking up your point, Grace, about all these things that happen behind the scenes and the years of effort and work that can go into getting an outcome, we have seen this week a really interesting development in the Epstein case where it seems institutions are finally being held responsible for some of the myriad crimes that were being taking place, led by Epstein, of course, but enabled by so many. And JP Morgan is having to stump up $290 million worth of cash as a settlement. That's US dollars, so about 422 million Australian dollars, to Epstein's victims because they turned a blind eye to the money that was flowing in and out of his accounts that enabled the ongoing abuse to take place.
Correct. So on Monday, a US judge granted preliminary approval to JP Morgan Chase's $290 million settlement with women who said Epstein abused them and that JP Morgan, which is USA's largest bank, as you said, there was the argument that they didn't just ignore. In 2008, there were investigations that were going on into some of the findings in Florida, and JP Morgan continued having Epstein as a client.
So these were these were the first, and really until he was rearrested, these were the only charges that had been brought against him on the issue of child sex abuse and rape. And the sweetheart deal was done with the then Attorney General. So he got
Acosta.
Yeah.
Alexander Acosta.
A rap on the knuckles and got to, day release to go and work in his office. But so even after this had happened, and this was sort of the turning point in the Epstein case, those who, once this had happened, the precious few who therefore severed ties, but those who, after he had been officially and legally found to be a child rapist, continued to befriend him, have close ties with him, and in JP Morgan Chase's case, do millions of dollars worth of business with him.
Yes, correct. Yes, he said Epstein was arguably the front man of a major scheme that clearly involved several fail safes and lots of different enablers to allow it to operate for a very long time.
And so part of the
small feat.
With JP Morgan Chase, they continued to have many associations with him because he was making them a lot of money and he was bringing in other wealthy clients into the bank. But there were also senior people in the bank, and this guy Staley, who was the CEO of the investment bank, seems to be a key person here.
1,200 emails they sent between them.
Yeah.
In the 4 years that he was at JP Morgan, apparently.
And that seemed to be, he got more enmeshed within the sexual criminal network that Epstein. So there was the financial networks, which a lot of people just wanted the money to rain down upon them. But then there were the darker allies, if you like, who were actually, clearly engaging with and involving themselves with the kind of the sexual criminal network that he was fronting.
And it's interesting because Jeffrey Epstein was operational in the finance world from at least the mid to late 70s. He started off at Burr Stearns firm and kept some clients there, even though he did some deals that allegedly went wrong. And he, he moved on from there, and his finances were being reported on by an English journalist, Vicky Ward, who worked for Vanity Fair in the late 90s, early 2000s, that turn of the century. And she actually stumbled upon what is termed colloquially as the quote-unquote girls around that time. And the then editor of the Vanity of Vanity Fair, Graydon Carter, I think his name is.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. So he actually made the editorial decision not to go ahead with her allegations. She had the mother of some girls and some girls making, they had made disclosures.
And they were prepared to go on the record as well. So he, like Vicky at that point, had multiple sources who were prepared to go on the record.
That's correct.
And instead.
That's her version of events. That's Vicky Ward's allegation. And this was around 2002, 2003, I believe.
Yeah, 2002. However,
And Graydon Carter made the decision to not publish, and he alleges that they didn't have enough sources to back up to publish. So that was you know, just after the turn of the century. He was under the pump, you know. There was information about what he was doing, not just about his dubious financial activities at that time. And Vicky had also been talking to a man called Stephen Hoffenberg, who alleges that he and Epstein had collaborated on the Ponzi scheme that wound up getting Stephen Hoffenberg convicted of a criminal offence and punished for about 18 years. So Vicky Ward went to visit Stephen Hoffenberg in prison. I think it was in Massachusetts, and was talking to him about his experience of Epstein. And Stephen Hoffenberg was actually quite enamored of Epstein when he dealt with him, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. And Stephen Hoffenberg was explaining how Epstein's grift, he called it, worked, which involved tying in any blackmail that he could get on his colleagues or business partners. And he alleges, Stephen Hoffenberg alleges, that it was Epstein who screwed him over while working on this sort of Ponzi scheme of like $450 million worth. Which is quite insane.
So, in fact, the sexual crimes of Epstein became critical material for him then to use in his business dealings with the sprawling network.
Other.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like it's, you know.
Is there no honour amongst pedophiles?
And that these stories, it's a bit like, you know, NBC spiking Ronan Farrow stories about Weinstein in the first instance before the New Yorker published them, that Graydon Carter would, like the profile, I remember reading it at the time and I was, I didn't know anything about Epstein then, and I don't think many people did outside of particular circles. And it just sounded, it was this weird kind of profile of just a New York kind of businessman and how he'd managed to ingratiate himself into all these different sort of social and business and political networks. You think, what's this story? And it turned out that was the sanitized version of what Vicky Ward had been writing. And I recall reading her talking about how she had never felt that she had betrayed sources more than when that story is, because it actually just boosted his profile. It didn't bring him down. It boosted his profile and made him more powerful in those circles.
But this is the failure to understand grooming. And I've tried to talk about this for years and years and years. And people are beginning to understand what it really entails. But grooming is an entire process. It's a stratagem that involves bribery. It involves blackmail. It involves creating this entire orchestra of fail-safes. And child sex offenders or offenders will go to any length that they possibly can to create an environment where they are insured against being found out through this system. And that's what it is. It's a really complex net of insurance policies so that if they crumble, so does everybody else who becomes enmeshed in such a complex way that they often don't realize that they've become enmeshed in this sticky spider web.
And over time,
so gradually, it's invisible and complicated. And yes, these, you know, you said it was over thousands, that the correspondence was in the thousands of individual communications.
God, how did he have the time?
And so to pick that apart, I mean, it's just...
Yeah, just like it.
Something with the JP Morgan case as well is that part of this, like, finding was that they continued working with him for 5 years after he'd already pled guilty.
Yeah.
To crimes, and that they were just deleting some of the emails involved in that where subpoenas were coming in. And it's like, so they also were caught in that web. But also when that whole thing of like when things started crumbling, they just committed to trying to put the web back up instead of...
Like maybe that's like the Labor Party. You just don't change strategy at this point. You're all
because
in.
Because you get... There's also this... In this day and age of surveillance culture, of Big Brother having this, omnipresent that you can't extricate yourself from, you... Even you know, like the most innocent human being, there's no real such thing, is going to err at some point. They're going to make a mistake. We're going to do something that is reactive, and that's how these perpetrators are really good at. And that's why they especially go for children. And there's this myth that of minor attraction, which is part of it in some cases, but part of the reason why they go for children is because children have not finished their psychological, physical, and social development. Therefore, because they are dependents, and what do we mean by dependent? We mean that they are literally, physically, socially, and neurologically dependent on an adult for them to model behavior. And so when a sexual predator especially starts doing things, even if it's quote unquote wrong, a child who hasn't got many other examples, and especially if a sexual predator starts isolating them from other examples, a child will start self-incriminating. But also so will adults if they're isolated, if they're under pressure, and if they're being blackmailed. They will start eventually self-incriminating unconsciously, because that is how the unconscious mind works. We don't necessarily realize that when we're under pressure, our logical mind disengages, and there are lots of different scientific markers for that. You can measure them in the endocrine system, the hormones, in the soma, in the viscera, and in our cognitive behavior, in our ability to intellectually reason. And you know, the conservative love state say, deal with facts. Well, those are facts. Those are facts.
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's very interesting that now at this point in time, it seems that institutions are being held accountable. And when it starts to cost them money, maybe that's when they'll change their behaviours. And so as part of this settlement with JP Morgan Chase is that they haven't conceded liability, of course. That's why they wanted to have an out-of-court settlement, so there's no judicial enforcement.
This is just the beginning. And this is just the beginning. And I find it very interesting that on just the day after this event, there is this proliferation in the Australian news environment of all this new information about how it was the poor security in the Metropolitan Correctional Centre that allowed for Jeffrey Epstein to allegedly commit suicide. I find that really interesting.
So it's kind of deflection. It's the sawdust in the eyes thing. Look over here.
Of course it is. Where's all this coverage about JP Morgan? Because who else is implicated, considering that JP Morgan is the biggest bank in the United States? Therefore, I reckon there are other people who are implicated, and we're probably going to find out more about that down the line.
Yeah.
Because Deutsche Bank was also, there was a $75 million settlement with Deutsche Bank that was also recent. We didn't hear much about that either.
But I didn't know about that until reading about this one.
And look, if you want any sort of numbers behind what you're saying, Grace, I just Googled Epstein and it brings up the top stories. There's seven top stories highlighted. Six of them are about this recent thing about cause of death revealed and the jailing thing. And there's one article about the JP Morgan one down the bottom, which is the Guardian piece. So
I rest my case.
Yeah, whoever came up with that PR strategy, deserves a pay rise.
Yeah, and probably has got a pay rise out of Epstein's estate. Yeah. Well, look, I think there will be more on this to come because our intrepid reporter, Grace Tame, is on the case here, and there were some really interesting further discussions that we were having before we started recording that we'll come back to when we've got it legally vetted.
Yes. You don't do it with me on because I have a track record of not doing things that our lawyers like.
That's very true.
Thank you for listening today. We will be back next week. But in the interim, do not forget this Sunday, First Community Day, Yes 23. Head to the website and turn out and do the grassroots work. Don't leave it all to our Indigenous brothers and sisters.
Cool. Our gear is from Rode and we are part of the Iconoclast Network. See ya.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.